policies. As your other commentator mentioned, the International Criminal Court is simply a tool of the West, a tool of NATO. These things need to be changed, and these are major undertakings that aren't going to happen overnight. But as we're talking about them, and as you point out before, we're looking for change. We're seeing the possibility of change that wins. But today, the Palestinians are suffering horrifically in Gaza, and that isn't changing. And it doesn't appear that it's going to change anytime soon because of the actions of Israel, the United States, and some other major world powers.
Okay, and on that note, appreciate both of you being with me on this spotlight. Craig Murray, former British ambassador to Uzbekistan out Edinburgh. Robert Fatina, author and journalist out of Kitchener, Ontario. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 146 to 148 of chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parisgar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Wa ka'ayyim min nabiyyin qatala ma'ahu ribbiyyun kathir. فَمَا وَهَنُوا لِمَا أَصَابَهُمْ فِي سَبِيلِ اللَّهِ وَمَا ضَعُفُوا وَمَا اسْتَكَانُوا وَاللَّهُ يُحِبُّ الصَّابِرِينَ وَمَا كَانَ قَوْلَهُمْ إِلَّا أَنْ قَالُوا رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا فِي أَمْرِنَا رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا فِي أَمْرِنَا وَثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَنَا رَبَّنَا اغْفِرْ لَنَا ذُنُوبَنَا وَإِسْرَافَنَا رَبَّنَا فِي أَمْرِنَا وَثَبِّتْ أقدامنا وانصرنا على القوم الكافرين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين فآتاهم الله ثواب الدنيا وحسن ثواب الآخرة والله يحب المحسنين.
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. And how many a prophet has fought with whom were many worshippers of the Lord? So they did not become weak-hearted on account of what befell them in Allah's way, nor did they weaken, nor did they abase themselves. And Allah loves the patient. And their saying was no other than that they said, Our Lord, forgive us our faults and our extravagance in our affair, and make firm our feet and help us against the unbelieving people. So Allah gave them the reward of this world and better reward of the hereafter. And Allah loves those who do good to others.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel's relentless strikes on Gaza result in more civilian casualties, pushing the death toll from the ongoing genocide to over 26,600. Israeli occupation forces conduct more raids on the West Bank, causing further distress as they target a hospital in Jenin, killing three young Palestinians. And Iran refutes U.S. allegations of involvement in attacks on American forces, emphasizing that Tehran is not responsible for actions by any group or individual in the region. Thanks for joining us. The Israel regime has struck residential buildings across the Gaza Strip, killing more than 200 people in 24 hours. 20 people, mostly women and children, were killed in a strike that targeted a building in Gaza City. Israeli warplanes bombed the Nuseirat refugee camp in central Gaza, while residential buildings in the southern city of Khan Yunis were also shelled. The overall death toll now stands at more than 26,600. The head of the International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies say that the healthcare system in Gaza is on the brink of collapse. Officials in Al Amal Hospital in Khan Yunis say that they have suspended surgeries due to a lack of oxygen supplies. Hospitals have been a central target of Israel's attacks. The regime forces have also struck ambulances marked with the Red Cross or Red Crescent's emblem, often in proximity to hospitals. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has ruled out any temporary truce with Israel in Gaza. Senior Hamas official Taher al-Nunu called for a complete and comprehensive ceasefire before any prisoner exchange deal with Israel. He added that Israel is hindering an agreement because it is at odds with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's personal interests. Earlier, the Qatari Prime Minister said progress was being made on securing a prisoner swap framework between Hamas and the Israeli regime. Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani announced that the prisoner swap framework will be communicated to Hamas. He made the announcement after meeting with U.S. and Egyptian officials and Israeli representatives in Paris. Meanwhile, Israeli forces have carried out yet another deadly raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. 3 young Palestinians were killed during the attack on a hospital there. The regime's troops also carried out separate incursions into the Nur Shams refugee camp in the city of Nablus. The cities of Tulkarm and Al-Haril witnessed fresh Israeli raids as well. Since October the 7th, the regime has intensified its raids and arrests across much of the occupied territories. Israel's military and settlers carry out incursions into different areas of the West Bank almost on a daily basis, killing or abducting Palestinians. Earlier, our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kondil, filled us in on the latest Israeli acts of violence in the West Bank, including in Jenin.
What happened is that Israeli special forces, or the undercover units, those Israeli soldiers disguised as civilians, raided the Ibn Sina hospital using silencer pistols, and they killed the 3 Palestinians. This is what the people and the crew patients inside the hospital have revealed. The 3 Palestinians who were shot and killed by the Israeli forces were 2 brothers, Muhammad and Basil al-Ghazawi. One of them, Basil or Muhammad, was wounded by the Israeli forces in a drone strike 3 months ago in Jenin. I knew he was in serious condition, and he was being treated inside the hospital of Ibn Sina. And there was with the brother accompanying him, Basil al-Ghazawi, and there's the third one, their friend Muhammad Jalamni. The Palestinians or the Saraya al-Quds is saying that Muhammad al-Ghazawi was a leader of the Jenin Brigades. Since the 7th of October, we are speaking about over 380 Palestinians, with the 3 Palestinians who were killed now. This means the number of the people who were killed is over 380 Palestinians were shot and killed by the Israeli troops across the occupied West Bank.
The call by Israeli ministers for the reestablishment of settlements in the Gaza Strip has sparked an international backlash. Nearly a third of the ministers in the Israeli cabinet attended a conference that called for mass Palestinian displacement from Gaza and the return of settlers to the territory. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry slammed the meeting as colonial. Hamas said the conference revealed the Israeli intentions to implement the crimes of displacement and ethnic cleansing against Palestinian people. Israel's Western allies also condemned the meeting. France said it is not up to Israel to decide where Palestinians should live, while Germany rejected the meeting as unacceptable. The United States also condemned the remarks made at the meeting as reckless and incendiary. Iran has denied responsibility for the actions of resistance groups targeting U.S. interests in the region. Iran's ambassador to the U.N. says the country does not directly or indirectly control any group or individual in Syria, Iraq, or elsewhere in the region. Amir Said Iravani made the comments in a letter to the Security Council president. He was responding to what he described as unfounded U.S. allegations linking Iran to attacks on American facilities and personnel. Iravani also stressed that U.S. actions in Syria and in Iraq are in violation of international law and the U.N. Charter. Regional resistance groups have been carrying out almost daily attacks on U.S. bases since Israel launched its onslaught on Gaza on October 7. They hold the U.S. responsible for the Israeli genocide in the Strip due to its military and diplomatic support for the regime. Tehran and Islamabad emphasized joint efforts in the fight against terrorism as a threat to both countries. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian and Pakistan's Chief of Army Staff General Syed Asim Munir expressed determination to maintain close cooperation to block any act of sabotage. In a meeting in the Pakistani city of Rawalpindi, the two sides agreed on implementation of a mechanism to deploy military liaison officers to fight common threats. Iranian and Pakistani top officials also stressed commitment to promoting peace and stability in border areas. The Iranian Foreign Minister also met with the Pakistani Prime Minister Anwar ul Haq Kakar, discussing the expansion of economic ties at the joint borders. Amir Abdollahian already met with his Pakistani counterpart, emphasizing the necessity for further steps to fight terrorism.
Today, the 2 high-ranking delegates and delegations of Pakistan and Iran We agreed together in order to take further actions as soon as possible when it comes to border security, necessity of fighting against terrorism, expansion of trade, commercial and economic cooperation, establishment of the joint border markets, and opening of the border crossing, as well as establishment of the free trade zones.
Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a joint presser with his Pakistani counterpart in Islamabad. The top diplomat said that Iran and Pakistan will cooperate to prevent terrorists from endangering the security of the two nations. He noted that Iran considers Pakistan's security as its own and that of the whole region. For his part, Jalil Abbas Jilani said the two countries have agreed to establish a high-level consultation mechanism to battle terrorism. The top Pakistani diplomat added that Tehran and Islamabad will also take measures to improve their economic relations. Political analyst Sabir Abu Maryam believes that Tehran and Islamabad settling their issues is a very good development in the face of their common enemies.
This is a very good development and sign that the both nations and both countries are jointly thinking and thought about the common enemy is the terrorism. So this is a common interest, this is a common cause to fight against the terrorism. The separatist groups, even in Kurdistan, even in Balochistan, those are funded and supported by the United States, Israel, and even in Pakistan, we are witnessing that the India is also involved in the separatist group. And the same in Iran side, U.S. and Israel, which is the common enemy of Pakistan and Iran. So this time is very important time that the Pakistan and Iran, they both are make some efforts to create a good peace in the Balochistan. Today, we feel that all the enemies, those who are trying to create the chaos, create the lines between the Pakistan and Iran, they are hopeless now today when the Iranian and Pakistani foreign ministers are jointly saying for the common interest, for the common economy. This is the reality. Because why? Our culture, our religion, our many things. We have many common things between Pakistan and Iran, and it is the common interest for both of them to work jointly for peace, for international causes, for especially for Palestine and other causes.
Americans have held a new pro-Palestine rally in California to press Vice President Kamala Harris to support for a permanent ceasefire in the Gaza Strip.
I'm here today actually with a coalition of other healthcare workers who are dedicated to calling for a ceasefire and dedicated to the liberation of Palestine. What's going on right now is a genocide, it's a human rights violation, it's a massive public health crisis, and we are here to call upon Vice President Harris to call for a ceasefire and to send immediate humanitarian aid to Gaza. What we need to call for now is not only an end to the genocide, but an end to funding Israel.
Harris was visiting the city where protesters were out on the streets to condemn the ongoing Israeli atrocities against Palestinians. The demonstrators also told people who were lining up to see Harris to ask the vice president to support Palestinians' rights. Anti-Israel rallies have been held across the U.S. on numerous occasions to condemn Israel's genocidal war on Gaza and demand an immediate ceasefire there. Also in the U.S., there is a growing outcry against the intense intimidation tactics which pro-Palestinian students are facing at educational institutions across the country. The refusal to protect not just pro-Palestinian speech, but pro-Palestinian human beings is the latest example of dangerous hypocrisy in favor of Zionism. Ramin Mazari has more from Chicago.
This week, students at Harvard University filed a civil rights complaint against the school for not protecting pro-Palestinian students from, quote, terrifying and unchecked harassment. As the devastating effects of the so-called Palestine exception to free speech continues to wreak havoc at campuses across the nation.
When there is anti-Palestinian bias, it's not addressed and it's ignored. But when there is accusations of anti-Semitism, everyone's involved, it's highlighted. And so we do see an extreme difference in that. If, you know, campuses across the country are concerned about anti-Semitism, which they should be concerned, and now at this point they're concerned about anti-Israel bias, why are they not concerned about Palestinian bias? Especially, you know, Palestinians were grieving. I have students that have lost multiple family members. And then while they're, you know, having this anxiety and they have to study, they're also being vilified at the same time.
At the University of Illinois campus in Chicago, supporters of Palestine described how students and professors feel criminalized, intimidated into silence, and sense a threat of punishment for defending Palestine openly.
But I do think many, many faculty are just simply afraid to broach the topic because of their fear of consequences, whether that's, you know, people taking photographs of them, their lecturers videoing them and posting them on websites that will blacklist them. If they're being followed on campus, for example, that's something we've certainly had outside groups following students, following faculty, taking photos of them. And we don't know what's going to be used, creating dossiers on us and submitting them to administration. Like, these are all possibilities to repress pro-Palestinian advocacy and really sort of raise the intimidation and repression on campus.
When professors describe being openly stalked while on campus, which is supposed to be a secure area for students and teachers, the scale of the intimidation, hypocrisy, and injustice which Palestinians and their supporters are subject to becomes crystal clear.
You know, my experience is I've been followed on campus, you know, for up to an hour at a time, just following and taking photos, not engaging, not saying anything. I've had my photograph taken while giving public talks, while walking on campus. And again, it's not clear how these documents are going to be used or what the purpose of the intimidation is, which makes it that much more intimidating because we don't know what is going to happen, you know, what's down the line, what's, you know, what the future holds in terms of our safety.
Across the country, people have been punished for speaking out in favor of Palestine. And not just in academia. Death threats, lost jobs, and visits from security agencies have all been a part of the nation's largest Islamophobic wave since Donald Trump's so-called Muslim travel ban of 2017. The first solution at the University of Illinois and many other campuses is to overturn the intellectually false institutional policies which equate anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. The goal of the repression is obviously to raise the costs of speaking out. But Palestinian activists say they will never remain silent about Israel's atrocities. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea has once again fired multiple cruise missiles into the sea off the country's west coast amid tensions with some of its neighbors, as well as the U.S. South Korea's military says Pyongyang has launched its cruise missiles thrice in less than a week. It did not disclose the type of cruise missiles, but said that South Korea and U.S. intelligence authorities are closely monitoring the situation and analyzing the details. The latest developments came as tensions running high on the Korean Peninsula following a South Korean military training near the border with the DPRK last week. Since last year, Pyongyang has also tested a number of missiles, including IBMs. Recently, the DPRK leader, Kim Jong-un, also called to boost nuclear arsenal, arguing that the U.S. is making war inevitable. Kim is against military drills between the U.S. and South Korea, which he portrays as rehearsals for invasion. And that is for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
The world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
in the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we made you familiar with the views of Irish professor Fred Halliday, who has made researches on international relations and West Asian issues. Today, we are going to sum up the views of those Western researchers whose views we have presented to you on the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Stay tuned, please. The Islamic Revolution has been focused by many thinkers and researchers across the world due to its unique nature and the unmatched impact it has had on global developments ever since its victory in 1979. Michel Foucault was one of the outstanding thinkers whose views we presented to you briefly on the Islamic Revolution and its peerless leader, Imam Khomeini. The Islamic Revolution emerged in the age when religion had been isolated, especially in the social aspects of life. French thinkers, Foucault, did not follow his contemporaries to call religion as the opium of masses. In fact, this was the famous belief of the German thinker, Karl Marx. Foucault had indeed believed in another statement of Marx, where he had said, "Religion is the spirit of a spiritless world." Foucault considered religion as a generating, converging, and creative force which puts forward a novel kind of discourse and method of living. The French researcher maintained that the Iranian Shah had omitted ordinary, unofficial powers like opposing political parties and groups, neglecting that this would reinforce the dispersed network of power among people. He calls the Shah and the army as the explicit symbol of power and violence against people's congregated and accumulated power. He opines that religion, spirituality, and congregated willpower, coupled with Imam Khomeini's highly influential and charismatic personality, were the core of the Islamic Revolution. In short, Michel Foucault is of the opinion that Iran's Islamic Revolution demonstrated the glory of faith and willpower and the lofty Islamic culture to the world. Ahmed Algar was another thinker who spent years to research on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. This British thinker maintained that the Islamic Revolution would have never gained victory had there not been Imam Khomeini to lead the people. He, like Michel Foucault, believed that no other group of the so-called rightist or leftist parties was able to unite people around a single cause. He says that in the horizon of Iran, there was no other person to be comparable to Imam Khomeini and his invitation. Algar considers Imam Khomeini's courage very important in making hard decisions. He refers to Imam's firm link with religious establishments and his deep attention to Islamic wisdom and irfan, which is cognizance. The British thinker gives high role to Imam Khomeini's spirituality in his confrontation with enemies. Nikki Keddy was another Iranologue and researcher of West Asian studies from the University of California. She called the Islamic Revolution as Iran's cultural reaction to the unwanted presence of the American imperialism in the country. The American University lecturer says that the high level of dependence on the U.S. during the Shah regime caused innumerable economic calamities in Iran. This led to uniting of people by Imam Khomeini to stage a great revolution to cut off the hands of foreign occupiers in various domains of the country. Kedi highlights two characteristics as the main parts of Imam Khomeini's personality, namely being uncompromising and resolute. Armenian-American University lecturer Yervant Abrahamian is another thinker who has studied on the Islamic Revolution and Imam Khomeini. In his opinion, although the Shah had made economic and social developments, he had forgotten to form a matching political structure. Like most thinkers, he too believes that Imam Khomeini played the main role in bringing the hearts of people together and the victory of the Islamic Revolution. For sure, his unprecedented popularity among people from all walks of life was very effective in this regard. Abrahamian, however, pays attention to Imam Khomeini's simple way of life as another feature of his disposition, alongside his being uncompromising against the illegal and illegitimate ruler. The American University lecturer says that the Imam ably caused potential powers among people to converge on a single course and mobilize them in the struggles to topple the oppressive and dependent regime. In continuation of reviewing the opinions of Western thinkers of Imam Khomeini and the Islamic Revolution, we talked about the views of John Foran and Fred Halliday. John Foran from the University of California in Santa Barbara focuses on the despotism of the Pahlavi regime and the dominance of foreign powers, particularly the U.S., on Iran as the two main causes of the Islamic Revolution. Reviewing the two revolutions of constitutionalist movements and oil nationalization during the past 1.5 centuries, he stresses that both movements failed due to the defeat of the people's resistance. He then goes on to say that Imam Khomeini's leadership was very effective and determining in the formation and victory of the Islamic Revolution. Irish University lecturer Fred Halliday also said in a speech in 2008 that the Islamic Revolution is the most modern revolution in the history of mankind, while it was a non-violent development. Like others too, he too is of the opinion that Imam Khomeini played a key role in the formation and triumph of the Islamic Revolution. He then continues that the transition of power after the Imam's passing away was a very great achievement in the history of the revolution and an unprecedented event in the history of Iran and the regional nations. He correctly says that the peaceful transition of power after the Imam's demise and the people's reaction to this was a prominent sign of his legitimacy and that of the Islamic Republic system. Halliday points to the ideological basis of the Islamic Revolution, such as independence seeking, convergence of Islam and democracy, strengthening of Iranian identity, and so on, and considers Imam Khomeini's simple way of life and his honesty as the most important factors for his unmatched popularity among world leaders. A noteworthy point in Fred Halliday's views is that he seriously distinguishes between the nature of the Islamic Revolution and the personality of Imam Khomeini and the extremist and savage views of Taliban and Al-Qaeda selfies. He maintained that Iran enjoys a very rich and bright history and owns a very lofty cultural, economic, political, and scientific status among the regional nations.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
The History of the Land of Palestine.
Part 5.
As I look to the north, I see the fertile plains of Syria and Lebanon. In the east, the vast and bountiful valleys of the Tigris and Euphrates. And in the west, the land of the Egyptians. These were the words spoken by Menachem Begin, the former Prime Minister of Israel. However, his words were in contradiction with the previous discourse of the Zionists. Previously, the Zionists spoke of exile, the Holocaust, and oppression. But after formation of Israel, their language and speech changed. They utilized a new terminology that reflected a dangerous ideology. The Greater Israel. To them, the establishment of the Zionist regime on Palestinian land was just the beginning of a larger plan. Therefore, Ben-Gurion claimed, "This map is not our country's map." We have another map that future generations will implement. We must expand our territory from the Nile to the Euphrates. Look at the American Declaration of Independence. This declaration makes no reference to any specific boundaries. We are not compelled to define our borders. These were the words of former Israeli War Minister Moshe Dayan. He spoke of America, of occupation, the genocide of indigenous people, and land grab. In fact, Zionists had a strange plan. They wanted to model themselves after America and considered the conditions in a way that Palestine and its people resembled America and its native inhabitants. The Zionists saw themselves as sailors and explorers, with the difference being the Zionists considered the land of Palestine as their ancestral inheritance.
What kind of history is it that the Arabs live here for 2,000 years and they were kicked us by us out? We lived here, sir, for the last 3,500 years and more. Now, we came back to the land of our ancestors.
In this way, all strategies used to occupy America were employed for occupying Palestine. Daydreaming begins. In their dreams, the Zionists rule over Palestine from the Nile to the Euphrates, the Middle East, and even the world. The existence of counterparts in America and Europe would have facilitated the establishment of geopolitical relations and brought about political power for Israel, making it akin to a kind of global government. But such mentalities were dangerous and found opposition. Therefore, the creation of an organization for suppressing opponents was put on the agenda. This organization is called Anti-Defamation League to suppress critics as a pressure group. With increasing economic power of the Zionists, the Anti-Defamation League influenced the American political arena and even the Council on Foreign Relations. Zionists in America and Europe received support and backing, while critics and protesters were suppressed. The establishment of the Zionist regime was highlighted under the pretext of the Holocaust. All the documents related to the Holocaust were doubted. Years later, criticism begins, and critics are pursued and even punished. Some of the most significant criticisms and revelations came from within the intellectual communities. Ilan Pape, a professor of political science at the University of Haifa, addresses the issue of ethnic cleansing in Palestine in his book. Civilians were killed, villages were destroyed. At least 1 million men, women, and children were expelled from their homes. Ilan Pape faced harsh reaction and was expelled from the university. Gradually, other intellectuals also speak out. Israel had a sinister and complex political plan in the form of colonial occupation executed in a brutal manner. The situation was alarming because Israel's crimes could be concealed. Martial laws have been enforced in Palestine for years, infringing upon the rights and freedoms of the people who are simply harassed and abused.
24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Yeah, the idea is that every Palestinian would feel the military is right here.
In fact, a dual judicial system had been established in Israel. Muslims were deprived of services, welfare, and basic rights.
And since 67, no more drilling, no more development, no more nothing. We stopped at this point.
They were arbitrarily detained and placed in narrow and solitary cells, mostly subjected to torture. Even though they were innocent, they were tried and sentenced in military courts. Strangely, upon release, they could be killed, even women and children. Israeli society bore many similarities to American society. Arabs were treated as African Americans, and they were more likely to be tried and imprisoned compared with the Zionists. A form of ethnic cleansing was underway, a combination of racism and systematic slaughter. The Zionists, who were complaining about Nazi German camps, had imprisoned Muslim people in a camp the size of Palestine.
This whole country is like a prison.
We feel like birds in a cage. We have all the comfort and food we have, but we have no freedom. My life and existence is always being threatened.
Colonialism, apartheid, and occupation were underway. The immigrants did not have ideal conditions, especially those who arrived in Israel after the days of catastrophe or Nakba. They were not allowed to settle in large cities. Instead, they were settled in temporary camps and then transferred to settlements. The policy of settlement building was hostile, aiming to prevent the return of Palestinians, and was considered a form of defensive shield. The protests of Eastern Jews began in the summer of 1959, starting from the city of Haifa. The next wave of protests took shape in the following decades. African immigrants also felt a different form of racial discrimination in their bones. As protests became widespread in Israel, Israeli experts and sociologists became involved and realized that something from within was challenging Israel. A crisis. Israeli sociologist Jonathan Shapiro in his books refers to the crisis as a major factor. The Israeli elites were exploiting the people. The necessity of creating a so-called nation for Israel was carried out at the expense of oppression by the majority, and minorities were in the worst situation. The chaotic situation of the parties was the most important factor in the crisis. There was no guarantee of minority rights. Arabs were in isolation and regression, being used as cheap labor for menial jobs. Israel was introduced as a model where a few different individuals from different countries had successfully come together and formed a nation. These were references to the Ashkenazis, as well as important institutions and organizations such as Haganah, Jewish Agency, Theodor Herzl, Weizmann, Menachem Begin, Ben-Gurion, Ariel Sharon, and Central Committees were all Ashkenazis. Historical books taught in schools were also about the Ashkenazis. Other Jews had no share in historical books because they were considered backward and primitive. Historically, being Jewish or Arab was not an issue. Jews lived comfortably among Arabs, but with the formation of Israel, problems arose. The Israeli society was filled with hatred towards Arabs. Arab immigrants were forced to hide their Arab identity. Concealing their Arab identity and constant suppression had turned into self-hatred. The solution ahead was what had been used in America, the melting pot theory. According to this theory, individuals from different societies come together in one place and interact, and a new society is formed. A new society that, while being homogeneous, also possesses the individual and social characteristics of different social groups. But Ben-Gurion's melting pot had many flaws. Racism was the most significant challenge. The next challenge was the rule of the elites. The founders of Israel sought to have Israel ruled by the elites, similar to America. Thus, a specific class in Israel was empowered as the guardians and protectors of the fundamental values of society to prevent the masses from challenging the fundamental principles of Israel. The plan had many benefits for the Ashkenazis. In the Jewish history, there are also signs of a class of nobility that sacrificed part of the Jews in times of emergency. A combination of racism and racial discrimination, along with the rule of a group of dominant elites and nobles who sacrificed people for their own interests. What fate will it bring? Politically, since 1949, left-wing parties have come to power in Israel and formed cabinets. In 1977, Menachem Begin of the Likud party came to power. In the 1980s, the Shah's party gained power, but again, it is Likud that takes the lead in Israel. In the 1990s, a young politician in Israel rises to power, Benjamin Netanyahu. He is U.S. educated with strong connections, including with Mitt Romney, the U.S. presidential candidate, and Menachem Schneerson, an influential rabbi. He shook hands with chairman of the Palestine Liberation Organization, Yasser Arafat, plotted an assassination attempt on senior Hamas leader Khaled Meshaal, and has been embroiled in corruption and graft. But after the events of 2000 and Israel's withdrawal from Lebanon, Ariel Sharon comes to power. He is officially a criminal and has a long history of killing and crimes against Palestinians. In his record, the massacre of unarmed people in the village of Al-Kubaya and the Sabra and Shatila massacre stand out. The number of casualties resulting from Sharon's actions is never clear because he takes pleasure in burning Palestinians.
We warned.
When Sharon brings war and terror, he faces defeat. With Israel's defeat in the 33-day war, something in Israel is fundamentally hurt: security. Right-wingers attract people's attention with extremist slogans. Meanwhile, Netanyahu, who has the support of Jewish rabbis and American advisors, has a better position. He comes to power with numerous promises and, based on his business background, implements economic reforms to garner public satisfaction through economic growth. Ehud Barak was considered a tough opponent of Netanyahu's. In 1999, he came to power with a promise of ending the war in Lebanon. Ehud Barak was one of the main commanders in the Lebanon War. He had pursued advanced studies in systems analysis at Stanford University in America and logically had concerns about any Israeli action to take over Palestinian territories such as the West Bank, the Jordan River, and the Gaza Strip, which would officially lead to the formation of an apartheid regime. Because in the event of voting in Palestinian territories, Palestinians would definitely vote for the Palestinian government, posing a fundamental challenge to Israel. The Zionist solution to the problem was a perpetual siege and war with Palestine. That is why the Gaza Strip turned into a large prison. A few years later, when Ehud Barak becomes war minister, he proposes a solution to previous failures: war. During Operation Cast Lead, Israel attacks the Gaza Strip for 22 days. Phosphorus bombs rain down on the people. They attack rescue forces, hospitals, women, and even children. In this war, the infrastructure of Gaza is destroyed. Israeli soldiers abduct and use Palestinian children as human shields on the streets. Israel officially commits war crimes. However, this war did not bring any achievements. Ehud Barak, as a main culprit, steps aside to allegedly bring fresh blood into Israel's political system. He was seeking extensive changes, but his failure against the resistance leads to the resurgence of Netanyahu. Until Netanyahu, security took precedence over everything in Israel, and every issue became a matter of security. But during Netanyahu's tenure, Israel faces a new challenge. The challenge of extremism. As long as Israel was winning, militarism was considered an honor. The army was the best interpreter of the Torah, and Arab defeats added to the excitement. Meanwhile, Netanyahu, who considered himself an expert in terrorism, turns to terrorism and, on the other hand, tries to achieve concessions through negotiations. And then he seeks to attract the satisfaction of extremist Zionists. That is why the provisions of the Madrid and Oslo Accords are replaced in the Trump Peace Plan, or so-called Peace to Prosperity. In 2018, discrimination becomes legally apparent in Israel, and Israel violates all international resolutions. According to this law, Israel is exclusively identified as a nation-state of the Jewish people, perpetually denying the rights and privileges of Muslims and restricting the Arabic language. In 2021, four families in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood in Jerusalem are ordered to leave their homes. They fall victim to the regime's strange judicial system, which confiscates Palestinian properties. A month later, a hardline representative, Itamar Ben-Gvir, sets up his office under a tent in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. He is an extremist Jew who had a picture of Baruch Goldstein fixed on the wall of his house. Goldstein was a terrorist who attacked unarmed worshippers during Ramadan, pouring their blood. When Ben-Gvir sets up a tent in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood, the settlers storm in and the occupation of Palestinian homes begins. Creating tension and conflict, harassing and tormenting Muslims, forcing families to flee and replacing them with Jews was a permanent policy for occupying land and changing the demographic and identity of Jerusalem and Palestine so that other plans could be implemented thereafter.
You are stealing my house!
And if I don't steal it, someone else is going to steal it!
But militarily, especially after the 33-day war in 2006, the conditions of the battlefield had changed. Therefore, when an Israeli ship is attacked in 2021, it becomes clear that it was a retaliatory attack. Subsequent attacks seem to be responses to Israeli crimes. Israel, which thought it had created a constant nuisance for the resistance axis by cooperating in the production of Daesh terrorists, now finds itself in the midst of even a greater fire. In a society where any unethical relationships to achieve a goal were considered legitimate based on its teachings, there's also a dangerous extremist movement that try to remain hidden and never be revealed.
The Arabs are not equal citizens here.
The extremist movement in the political arena of Israel was so influential that someone like Netanyahu, the main culprit in the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin, came to power.
But he was there, and he didn't stop it.
The man in the blue t-shirt approached.
For this reason, Netanyahu tried to gather the approval of extremist groups for years.
To go back to Arab countries.
We have to kill him, and not because he's an Arab, because he's a terrorist. I think he should also kick out the family.
But extremism and racial discrimination not only face opposition from Palestinians, but also from the resistance front and other communities. Israel sees its security slipping away. Thus, Israel, which has historically oppressed people and plotted for the Middle East, finds itself on the path of contradictions in behavior and speech and the adoption of racist policies, leading to nothing but defeat and destruction.
In the limelight.
The impunity enjoyed by the Zionist regime troops determined to kill Palestinian children is bought and paid for by the Biden administration, which refuses to hold the Zionist regime forces to account for carrying out genocide in Gaza. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details.